Welcome to episode 22 of Forest Focus. I'm your host, Paul Wade, with the Regional Public Affairs and Communications Office. In this episode, we focus on Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month by speaking with three employees about their childhood, how they got involved in the Forest Service, and more. So join us in welcoming our guests, Hilda Kwan, a hydrologist on the Upper Lake Covelo Ranger District of the Mendocino National Forest here in the Pacific Southwest region. Jason Coe, a shared stewardship coordinator with the Pacific Southwest's regional office in Vallejo. And Arvin Buta, the acting National Forest Stewardship Program Manager in Incorporative Forestry at the Forest Service's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Thank you all for calling into the studio. Let's start with Hilda. Can you tell us about growing up as an Asian American Pacific Islander, or what we can now refer to as AAPI?
Yeah, so I grew up in a fairly traditional Chinese family in San Francisco. I would consider both my parents are immigrants from Hong Kong. My grandmother lived with us while I was young. And because going to school Monday through Friday wasn't enough, my parents enrolled me in Chinese school on Saturdays. So I got to learn the language. And we spoke it at home as well. We always had gatherings with my extended family because we celebrated all the American holidays as well as all the Chinese ones as well. And most of the family on my mom's side still live in Hong Kong. So growing up, we would go visit them almost like every other year. So I feel like I have a pretty strong connection with my Chinese heritage still.
Jason, how about you?
So I have a different experience than Hilda. I grew up with my parents and my sister in Sacramento, which is a pretty diverse city. And most of my exposure to kind of my Chinese heritage was actually through the church I belonged to and family, which I did not see as often. My parents moved to Sacramento from Seattle, so most of my extended family is in Seattle. So we didn't see them more than a couple times a year in the summers. On my mom's side, I'm fifth generation. On my dad's side, I'm third or fourth generation. And so neither of my parents speak Chinese. Oh, my mom does a little bit. And we speak English and my grandparents. And my dad's mom was, I think, the most Chinese influence of that family. And, she still did a lot of Chinese cooking and had some of them, a lot of more Chinese heritage items around the house. Yeah, so I think in my immediate household, I didn't feel like I was necessarily had a strong connection with my nuclear family, but through my extended family and some outside of school.
Arvin, tell us what it was like for you growing up.
For me, my Asian heritage, it's kind of a mixed bag. It's got one side that's Filipino. My mom is from the Philippines originally, and my dad, who is from the subcontinent of India, he's actually from India, and they both immigrated here in the late 60s, early 70s. as medical professionals. And so they both met in New York, and I would say probably New York City as well. That's where I was born. And I probably had a really deeper connection probably growing up as a kid with a lot of different people of different backgrounds. I remember growing up as a kid, I had a Korean babysitter who was a working kind of her husband was a working colleague with my dad. And my mom was always working as well, so she was a nurse, and she was taking care of me, and I grew up apparently picking up some Korean words and picking up a variety of different other words from other languages, and then that all changed. My dad decided to move to the southeastern United States, particularly in Montgomery, Alabama, and it was a very different experience from there. For me, I had to, assimilate into the culture of the southeast, and my parents did not teach me their languages. As I grew older, I think because of the issues of me picking up a variety of different languages and making my own words growing up, I had to get some help with a speech pathologist when I was younger, when I grew up here in Montgomery, Alabama. And they kind of just abandoned that aspect of of learning their languages, which is a sticking point for me today when I talk to them about it. They regret not having, you know, taught me their languages, which is still okay. And in terms of just learning more about you know, India and the Philippines, a lot of the things about the Philippines, especially from my mom, she's from the northern Philippines and then has that strong Catholic upbringing that's integrated into the culture of the Philippines. So I got a lot of that growing up. But because of that, you see those religious differences, my dad's Jain, and he really didn't get the opportunity to kind of share that with us just because of the religion issue. But I did learn a lot growing up as a kid about the different cultures and the different places that they were from. But really, it was more kind of just assimilated to growing up in the Southeast and kind of having to navigate these different spaces here in both American culture and then also, I guess, when the small, tiny Indian communities are here, the Filipino communities that were here, having to navigate those spaces. So it was always interesting, very, very much kind of left me, felt like a stranger in my own little place here. So exactly, that's how it was for me growing up here in Alabama.
Well, very interesting backgrounds and fascinating already. Arvin, you wanted to add something else?
It was very confusing for me to navigate, I guess, childhood and a little bit of adulthood, trying to figure out where I fit in, how I fit in, kind of direction in life and where I wanted to kind of take my career was really not well put together until I got probably into college and figured out kind of where I wanted to go with my career.
And Jason, a follow-up to the question?
So I did have, Asian and Chinese influences in my household, but I always felt like they weren't as strong as a lot of my other Asian friends, because for many reasons, just because my parents and their grandparents, my grandparents were all born in the U.S. But I should clarify that I did have those influences. We did participate in Chinese New Year celebrations, and there were red envelopes passed around occasionally, but definitely not to the level that a lot of my friends who I hung out with kind of experienced. And so I didn't actually identify, I think, as Chinese American or Chinese even of Chinese heritage until I left the country. And then other people identified me as such. And I think that was partially due to my high school. And then also in college, I went to the UC system here in California, which is, there's a lot of Asian Americans in that. And so I never really felt otherized too much until I went abroad, and then people were very, I definitely was like, okay, now I can see people see me as Chinese. And so that was kind of an interesting experience for me.
Hilda?
And, you know, I grew up in a highly urban area. And then I went to college at Humboldt State, where it's not very diverse. And I feel like I've kind of stayed on that trajectory ever since. But, it's really hard. And I can see from Jason's point of view, it's like, it's really hard to hold on to those roots if you know, you're like, from a distance stand of view, you're so far away from it. So I guess that's all I wanted to add.
I see Arvin, you have your hand up on the Zoom call. And please, Jason and Hilda, if you have anything more to add before we move on to the next question, just go ahead and come on after Arvin.
I mean, for me, I mean, growing up, of mixed Asian heritage, it was hard for me to kind of feel like I belonged in, like, you know, Indian or Filipino, because I really don't fit the bill. A lot of people confuse me for being Hispanic or Turkish. I've had people from South America ask me stuff in Spanish. And so it's kind of always add to some perplexity for me. And like, where do I fit in? How do I fit in? Because I don't, you know, I'm not 100% Asian of a certain heritage. So it's kind of like a mixed heritage. And it's always been interesting to figure out how to navigate growing up and even being a kid too.
My wife and I have been thinking a lot about, because my wife is from the Midwest and of Norwegian and German descent. And so our kids are mixed, Asian white, so to speak. And so we're trying to impart to them parts of both heritages, but like, don't want them to be confused either. So we're kind of exploring this right now with our young kids and like what to pass on and how do they identify. And so hearing your experiences, Arvin, is interesting.
Thank you very much, everyone. Now, regarding your careers, And we'll start with Jason. How did you get into a job in the land management and natural resources sector?
I think where it really started was I grew up camping a lot as a kid, you know, Boy Scouts with family, with friends and church. And so we grew up in the outdoors, and so did my parents did too. And so it was really strongly instilled to kind of be outside and hiking and backpacking and just enjoying nature. But that didn't really translate to a career option for me. It just never wasn't really in this realm of kind of consideration. You know, I went to college, I was engineering, but then I went undeclared and was trying to find my way, like I think a lot of kids. And I went to history and economics. And then I joined the Peace Corps just to go travel the world. And then I decided I wanted to do international work. But then I was like, then I started getting in touch with like, well, what do I really want? What am I passionate about? And, you know, wherever I went, and something I really missed in the Peace Corps, I was in Mauritania, which is like 99% desert, was kind of being outdoors in the forest. And, you know, for me in California, that was the Sierra Nevada and the North Coast for the most part. And so I realized that I really wanted to work in kind of that forested environmental sphere. And so I kind of combined that to my international kind of foray and that to kind of trying to get a master's degree that kind of combined the two in international environmental policy. And I got a internship with a U.S. embassy doing that kind of work in Congo, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And then I got a job doing with a contractor, a private sector in D.C., doing supporting U.S. government work, doing that abroad. And then found my way into Forest Service, doing that for the Forest Service International Programs in D.C. And then finally, my wife was looking to go back to school. She wasn't my wife then, but my then fiance or serious girlfriend was looking to go back to school in California, which was where my parents and sister are. And so I was like, oh, this is great. And so I was able to find a transfer out here to Region 5 and now be really grounded in kind of, you know, managing resources in Region 5 outside of just policy. So that's kind of my circuitous route to where I'm at. But I'm really happy. It's so great to be working in, you know, land management on places that are meaningful to myself, sustainably managing them for the future and my kids and everyone's kids and all the different kind of decisions that have to go into that. I think it's fascinating. And I really like the public service aspect of it all. So I'm really happy and proud to be working for the Forest Service.
Arvin, how about you?
Yeah, sure thing. So for me, it was kind of accidental in a way. I was really just wasn't sure what I wanted to do in college. I was undeclared for a good while as well. Thought I'd wanted to go into industrial design. I really used to draw a lot and like, oh, you'll be a great architect or something like that. I was like, industrial design seems pretty cool. And I just wasn't doing it for me. And so growing up as a kid, my parents were always like, you're going to become a medical doctor. And I was like, okay, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'll just go take some biology courses. And just by accident, I took a summer course and it was called Natural History of Vertebrates. And I would have to say that course got me hooked into what biology was all about, into the you know, evolution, ecosystems, all that, the whole entire ecology area of biology just really pulled me in, and I got hooked. And from there, I started taking a whole bunch of other courses that I didn't know I could take, and that really got me out into the outdoors. I had no knowledge whatsoever of the outdoors prior to that. I never really got the opportunity to do that with my parents. They had no idea about what was here in the Southeast, for example. And I had some really, you know, bad allergies and asthma as a kid growing up. And so they really limited my opportunities to get outside. There's always that fear of me getting an asthma attack. And I had numerous asthma attacks growing up as a kid. And so getting that opportunity to kind of just be outside, I was like, wow, this is a whole different world. And getting outside of that bubble of where my parents were saying, you can't do this, you can't do that. And I'm like, wow, this is really cool. And so that kind of just ignited everything in terms of my passion for ecology. And it kept on going on. And eventually kind of specialized in terrestrial vertebrate ecology, especially in herpetology and ornithology. And then did a lot of work as a biological technician. I've got to live in the Everglades National Park for 3 months. I've gotten to work on different federal lands, chasing gopher tortoises with a radio telemetry unit and capturing pictures of them mating. Did that for 2 years every day. It was a lot of fun.
And so that quest and that interest and the knowledge of like wanting to understand more about the area that I grew up in kind of just said, hey, it got me going. It's like, I want to go to graduate school. I have all these questions and ways of how do you answer these questions that really intrigued my mind. And was able to get into graduate school, but first I had to go back to undergrad again because my grades weren't the greatest either growing up for my first time in undergraduate school, because I was also trying to learn the lay of the land socially as a kid. So it took a little bit of maneuvering, but finally when I got my head on straight and I knew where I wanted to go, I ended up going back and getting an undergraduate degree in environmental science and geography, and that kind of led me into graduate school, and I got to get my master's and my PhD, and then do a postdoc, all in natural resources, all with some points touching into land management. And so it was really cool. And I never knew the opportunity for the Forest Service would be there. I'd always heard about it, but it just was never on my radar. My thoughts were like, oh, maybe I'll get a job in the federal government working with USGS or the Environmental Protection Agency, USGS being US Geological Survey. But I'd never thought about the Forest Service, and I never realized the connection that I had to the Forest Service, especially close to the university that I was at. The Tuskegee National Forest is actually right next door to where I did my undergrad, and I would go out there doing a lot of herpetological work and just having fun in the streams there, collecting data and looking at stuff for classes that we did. Yeah, that's where it kind of went from there. And honestly, it got to the point in the economy where I was like, oh, I might not be able to get a job in academia. It's very tough. Don't know what opportunities out there in the natural resources world. And I was actually looking at a position with one of the intelligence agencies, and I actually was waiting for that to come through with the security clearance. And then I applied for a demo job with the Forest Service and lo and behold, and I got it after an interview. So I was like, well, do I go do intelligence work or do I go to do something that I'm really passionate about? And I did have that passion for the intelligence side is related to GIS and remote sensing, but the opportunity to get to be connected to the land and doing some really cool work and the mission of the Forest Service, once I learned about it, was really intriguing to me. And I'm glad to be in the agency. And it's been a great time getting to learn of a variety of different jobs that different people do in this agency. It's really just really spectacular. And then also the connection to both federal lands and to also working with our private landowners in the current position that I'm in. So that's my story.
Hilda, how about your career journey?
So I think there's like two kind of events in my life that influenced me leading to where I am today. When I was in high school, I went to a pretty academically intense high school in San Francisco. And by the time I hit my junior year, I really wanted to explore my options outside of those like traditional careers, such as becoming a doctor or a lawyer or studying computer science. And somehow I found this organization called Student Conservation Association, SCA, and I signed up to be a trail worker for that summer. I was assigned to work on the Big South Fork National River and Recreation Area in northern Tennessee. And it was probably the first time in my young life that I've felt really uncomfortable. I was far away from home. The surrounding communities were extremely rural, and we lived out of a tent for a month during the heat of the summer. But once I got over that initial uncomfortable feeling, I honestly loved every part of that experience, especially living and working outdoors. Even the misery of the southern humidity or doing backbreaking work didn't bother me. And I think that was one of the times when I knew that I wanted to pursue a career in natural resources. I didn't really know exactly what that meant at that time, but I just had an idea of like where I wanted to see myself, and it was like outside in the woods working. So senior year in high school, I applied to a number of colleges and decided to go to Humboldt State and study forestry. I was lucky enough to land a seasonal job as a hydrologic technician after my first year. And I had a really awesome mentor who kind of hooked me on to the Forest Service. And she offered me the opportunity for a SCEP position. I believe that's Student Career Education Program, where you basically convert into a permanent position after graduating college. She also found this this little obscure program that the Forest Service was doing, where they put people through graduate school as well. And she got me through that. And so I was able to go to grad school through the Forest Service and do my master's, my thesis work on the Sequoia National Forest. That was kind of how I kind of got hooked onto the Forest Service. The second piece of kind of how my influence, I think, came from my dad, although not really like consciously, but like in hindsight, I'm like, wow, this is kind of an amazing story. So he came to this country when he was a teenager, and, you know, naturally he wanted to do all those things that are related to American culture. And one of those included experiencing the outdoors. And somehow him and his friends ended up going to this place called Lake Pillsbury on the Mendocino National Forest. And growing up, we didn't go camping as much like Jason did. But the couple times that we did go to Lake Pillsbury. And coincidentally, that's the piece of ground that I work on today. So I feel like it's kind of special being able to kind of come around full circle on that.
How can managers of public lands like the Forest Service engage better with the AAPI community in bolstering their visitation numbers, and certainly encourage future generations to get outdoors more? Let's go with Arvin.
Good question there. It's like, especially from growing up in the Southeast, most of the denser areas that have higher Asian Americans or Pacific Islanders are mostly going to be in your bigger cities like Atlanta or like Charlotte, especially also in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area. But in saying that, though, I've seen a lot of people who are of those heritages out and about in parks and city parks, and even in, I would say, your national parks that are in the Southeast. I've also seen out West as well. It's just like, I'm not quite sure. I guess it's just building a better awareness of that when people do come to go visit some of our federal lands, especially with the Forest Service, is like, how do we engage with those people that are visiting? People are aware of, like, when they go to a national park land, they know that if they're in a national park, they identify with that symbol of the National Park Service. They know where they're going, they know where they're at. And I think that's maybe something that maybe we're missing. And this is maybe even just general on top of just the AAPIs that are out there that are checking out our lands, is making that connection maybe through communities, and then also having that brand awareness of that symbol of the Forest Service, with the people that we're working with. And then when they see that symbol, it's like, oh yeah, Forest Service, I know that land and I know those people and I know the agency. And so just building that awareness and working, I guess, to do that would be more engagement with communities. You know, I'm thinking about our cities where we can engage with some of those communities in the cities and talk about the urban landscape and forests. And then also, some of the people that are owning lands nowadays, forested lands, are coming from the cities. And some of them are probably of Asian American or Pacific Islander heritage. And so it's an opportunity to connect with those landowners as well, and show them why their forest land that they've got really matters. Or even with those people who are in agriculture and maybe have a small area of those lands as forest, connecting with them in that way, showing the importance of what we do and the work that we do. But then also in terms of recreation, getting out there and just having that awareness that when I do hit a visitor area, this is Forest Service land, and this is a cool agency, and we have a lot of cool things to show, from, you know, going out there to see some beautiful waterfalls in Oregon, hitting the bristlecone pine forest in the White Mountains over there. I can think of in the Inyo National Forest and Mount Whitney, recreating there. And then, you know, when you're wanting to hit some of the ski slopes across the West in Colorado and other places, and also out here in the East where you have parts of the Appalachian Trail. So those are the things that I think about, is how do we build that brand recognition within our communities, not just the AAPI, but other ones as well.
Hilda, same question.
So I think Arvin is spot on in terms of outreaching to those communities, especially in, you know, you look at where the majority of the AAPI communities are, where the people are, they're in those urban, suburban areas. And I think part of why they don't know about national forests and the services that we provide is just because we don't necessarily outreach to them as much as we can. And I think, you know, by targeting those areas, that'll, you know, it takes time, right? You can't just do one event and have the whole community like buy into what we do. I just from my personal experience over the last couple of years, doing these specific outreach events, in Chinatown, San Francisco, or during some of these cultural events where we've had a Forest Service presence there, and not just explaining to them that, hey, you can go, you know, hike and camp here, but we also provide, you know, clean water and fresh air. You know, everyone likes those things, right? So just not, you know, not only in terms of visitation, but also some of those benefits that people don't think about every single day. And I just want to add that having, you know, if we're going to target a specific group like AAPI, having translated materials is so important. And that's something that I've worked with our civil rights group in developing some translated materials on, you know, who are the first Forest Service, what do we do? And then having that information that we can give people who, you know, may not speak English, but they can take something and they can read. So I think that's really important for us to kind of look beyond our traditional methods of outreach and kind of stealing some ideas from the Park Service almost, because they do a really good job at, you know, getting the word out who they are and getting people interested in visiting their lands.
Jason, how about your thoughts on engaging with the AAPI community better?
Yeah, I like what Arvin and Hilda said. I think it's spot on. I mean, I mean, honestly, from my perspective, and I have a pretty limited one to, you know, California, I guess at this point is, you know, especially for, you know, the Bay Area where I live. I mean, if you go up to the national forest that, you know, the Bay Area has access to, I feel like there's a pretty significant amount of, you know, Asian Pacific Islander populations out recreating and being in the outdoors. That being said, it's also important to recognize that the AAPI community is pretty diverse, right? I mean, you know, it can include people from who are ethnically Turkish, you know, to Indian, to, you know, Japanese and everything in between. And it's a very, very broad community with a lot of different languages and a lot of different cultural identities. And so I think I don't know that, you know, how what the breakdown is, but I'm sure there's opportunities to increase awareness of, you know, visitation opportunities that are more specific to certain parts of the AAPI community itself. And maybe those values aren't always, like Hilda said, camping or recreating, but, you know, the other values that are important to them in being in urban communities, like clean water, you know, conservation or biodiversity, conservation, et cetera. Yeah, in general, I mean, Forest Service, I was thinking about it because, like, you know, when Hilda, when you were talking about, you know, your place identification with Pillsbury Lake, is with Pillsbury Lake, right? It wasn't with Mendocino National Forest. And I think that's probably in contrast to a lot of other folks who identify with a national park. It's with Yosemite National Park, right? It's not going to be with like 12, well, maybe with 12 miles, but it's not going to be with a specific place within the park. And I think that's just due to the nature of how Forest Service manages lands. We're much more dispersed management presence across the landscape. And therefore, I think when people go to visit, they don't visit the Forest Service. They're visiting such and such lake or such and such campground. And that's where they identify. And like, you know, growing up camping in California, you know, monthly, I never knew I was going to Forest Service land. And if I did, it didn't impact me or didn't resonate that this is Forest Service land. In fact, I was going to Sly Park or going out to Elephant Back, you know, we're going to different places. And so that's, I think, a general kind of challenge I think Forest Service probably acknowledges. In comparison to some of our other land management brethren. Yeah, I think the language thing and it'd be really important to kind of understand kind of what are the vectors to reach those communities and what's important to them. And I think that, you know, it being so broad in terms of who's included, it will make it a challenge, but I think it's worth it because I think we need to remember that as managing public lands for the public good and for the public, that the public isn't who's coming. You know, it isn't just who's coming to visit the National Forest, and it isn't just who's calling our phones or coming to, you know, objections meetings or whatever. The public is a much broader, you know, group of people in the U.S. and in the world. And so we need to kind of, you know, reach out to that broader group and include them in the management and the decisions, and make sure they're aware of kind of what National Forest and Forest Headwaters do, and how they can be engaged and why it's important for them to be engaged as well. And I think we have a lot of work to do in that area.
Jason, you make some very good points there, because it isn't all about recreation. We are a multi-use agency, so there are a lot of things that directly affect people's daily lives coming from the Forest Service. Okay, any follow-ups? Hilda, I see you have your hand up. And then, of course, Jason and Arvin can come in at any time after that.
I think there's, you know, and this is like the tough part, I think, of this whole process, is understanding, you know, Jason's alluded to, you know, Asian Pacific Islanders, that's a really large and diverse group, and everyone's going to have their own, you know, nuance or their cultural way of seeing public spaces or outdoors. And I just want to share, you know, that I've met people who they think it's a really nice idea, but because, you know, their family might have come from, you know, like they might have gone through the Vietnam War and had to hike through mountains. And so, like, I think that, you know, there's still a little piece of that where, you know, some of that history in the background has caused people some sort of like trauma, if you will. And so, like, relating going outdoors and recreating and having a great time, like, that's really hard to translate when certain group of people have this other history related to, you know, being outside. So I think that's something that, you know, we also have to try to navigate as well, because I think it affects everyone differently.
With where Hilda was going, was kind of where I was going as well, is unraveling the differences in cultures across the AAPI, this realm, right? I mean, you know, it's such a huge area. And this is not just for the AAPIs, but I think it's for other people of other heritages too. It's like, how do you engage those people? And I think, you know, we do have, you know, the beauty of this agency is that we do have, you know, usually think of people who are foresters and ecologists and hydrologists and all that. But we also have sociologists, and we do have some anthropologists. We have urban foresters. We have landscape architects. We've got planners. We have people from a broad variety of different backgrounds and disciplines. And of course, we could always add more to the mix, but figuring out how we could be better ambassadors to those groups and engaging them and getting them to understand, you know, regardless of if it's trauma or if it's maybe a cultural thing or there are issues that are associated with their forest from maybe the areas that they came in, or perhaps even like professional opportunities that they might have not been aware of. You know, for like my parents, they had no idea that I could do what I'm doing as a job. And it's just not something they knew about. It wasn't in their toolbox of things to understand or know. So, I mean, how do we engage with those communities? And maybe that requires more sociologists, anthropologists, other people with those qualitative analytical skills to do things, developing the communications that we need, some more people in communications and HR, and figuring out how we navigate all this together as a bigger group, having a more inclusive work environment where those kind of connections can happen.
You told us your wonderful journeys navigating your careers. Any thoughts or suggestions on marketing land management or natural resource jobs to the AAPI community? Let's go back to Hilda first.
This is something that I've been thinking about for a while, how to navigate to get more AAPIs interested in natural resources jobs and working for the Forest Service. And I, you know, from between Arvin and Jason, I think, you know, they kind of alluded to this idea that, well, it's just it's the lack of knowledge, right? So my parents did not know about natural resources career. I kind of just stumbled onto it. thinking about it a little more, I think, you know, if the Forest Service really wants to start to have an impact, you know, I feel like our efforts has to be a multi-generational effort. And what I mean by that is, you know, for a lot of the first and second generation families, you know, grandparents are usually still like really active, you know, with the rest of the family, obviously. They spend a lot of time with their grandchildren. They're almost like the babysitters or the caregivers while both parents worked. And that was definitely the case for me. And so I think that older generation really has a strong influence over that younger generation. And so I think in terms of, you know, when we do these outreaches, it can't just be going to colleges and, you know, trying to recruit people who may or may not be in the natural resources, in one of those natural resources career already. I mean, I feel like we need to, you know, start way early and, you know, not just target the individual kid or the, you know, the child, but the whole family itself. So that's kind of one of the things that I've been kind of pondering about lately.
Question to you, Jason.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult question. I mean, again, not just speaking from the AAPI perspective, but I mean, just in general with immigrant communities or generally less affluent, you know, communities also, that, you know, the primary goal in, you know, in raising their children is to get good jobs that pay a lot of money so they don't have to suffer, you know, be impoverished like the other parents were, or why, you know, the immigrant families came here to seek a better life. And so I think a lot of times natural resource careers, or they don't even think of natural resource careers. They think, you know, working at a national park or at a camping site, that's seen as kind of a luxury, like passion pursuit, not a very successful pursuit. And so I think a lot of the kind of the traditional careers that are emphasized by even my parents, you know, engineering or medical field, those are seen as very safe and very successful careers. And not to say that, you know, natural resource careers, you know, aren't going to make as much as a neurosurgeon, right? But there's still a lot of, you know, there's still stable careers, especially for the U.S. government. So, like, you know, these are very good jobs. But I think so just kind of there's that communication piece needs to kind of be connected with, you know, maybe like Hilda was saying, with kind of the whole entire family saying, like, hey, this is a government job that you can do something that you're passionate about, you know, be outside, but also, you know, be contributing to the betterment of the community or of the state or what the world, what have you. But actually, it's kind of something else too. I mean, I heard this kind of casually, and I don't know the exact statistic, but someone told me that at one point that like 30 years ago, people joined the Forest Service to be out alone in the woods. They wanted to be, you know, have freedom and be outdoors and just be alone. And now it's shifted a lot towards people join the Forest Service because they want to save the world. Or, you know, for climate change or wildfires or what have you, right? There's this kind of greater good aspect to it. And so I think, yeah, how you reach and promote why you're joining the Forest Service, I think we need to kind of really look at kind of, it's not just the reasons that you might think of initially or that why you might have joined, but like really trying to understand what is important to the community and what are their values and for them and their children. And then seeing where there's a match with a career in the Forest Service. And, you know, because like I said, I didn't even know there was a career possibility in here. I didn't think it was a really viable career. You know, thought kind of like, you know, there's quote unquote outdoor bums who are kind of like, you know, hiking around and living in backpacks. And that was my idea of like a natural resource career. I didn't, you know, think there was actually professionals. It just wasn't even on my radar. And so how do you improve that misconception amongst young people? Especially young people who might not have been exposed to it through their own parents, you know, or their folks who are in their spheres growing up.
Arvin, final question to you.
This is a very multifaceted approach to doing all this. There's a lot of different ways that we have to figure out how to build these pipelines, not just within the Forest Service, but just within the natural resources community. You know, and that goes from like what we're talking about earlier with bringing in the families and making those connections with the families, having that, you know, K-12, you know, public and private education that's around, making sure that that's something that's pushed, the understanding of Earth and, you know, people getting a better grasp of the sciences and earth sciences and natural resources and, you know, geosciences and all that. So building that support pipeline by starting out early with K-12, also working with families and getting that communication out there, having people in leadership positions, not just, you know, in the Forest Service, but in other agencies that are land management based, and also other organizations, be it nonprofit or private sector, where they can see leaders in those organizations as well, up, you know, at the top, and seeing some familiar faces in those spaces helps, I think, a lot in terms of also adding to that, this multifaceted discussion we're having, where, you know, you've got to have that support there as well. So there's a lot of different angles and approaches that I see that we would have to take to build that pipeline into the agency. And then also providing opportunities for people within the agencies to move up, or even coming in at mid-career. I mean, I came into this agency mid-career. I didn't start, out in the field, although my background was out in the field. It just wasn't associated with the Forest Service. And so how do you provide, you know, those opportunities for growing a career in the agency? You know, also showing them is like, yeah, you're not going to always be out in the field, but you'll also be behind desk. You get to do a lot of cool different things. The interaction with community is there. Just trying to show people the different positions and career options you have in this agency. I think it's really cool. And I think if people see that and are made more aware of it through whatever we do through public relations, social media, I think that does help too. So like I said, there's a very broad, multifaceted approach that we need to take in terms of building these pipelines, bringing people in. And this is just for not just for APIs, this is for Hispanic and Black communities as well, and even white communities too. So it's like, how do you do this? How do you do it in the urban environment? How do you do it in the rural environment? How do you make those connections? The beauty of this agency too is our national forest systems, where people get to go out and recreate, but then also cooperative forestry, where we provide programs to urban and areas and also to rural areas, and making those connections with the public that way. And we have a research and development group that can probably provide some really cool research and better understanding of the science behind stuff. So yeah, there's so many different ways of approaching this. It's of course not one magic bullet, but it takes several different ways and several different approaches, I think.
One more thing, I think Arvin mentioned it, but I just want to put an emphasis on it. I think that Forest Service could really do a much better job about communicating the diversity of jobs that we have within the agency. And so it's, you know, it's not just recreation or forestry, but there's a whole bunch of, you know, geological science, earth science positions. There are engineering positions. There are financial, you know, budget administration. You know, there's a lot of different jobs in the Forest Service, and focusing not just on the College of Forestry at schools, but also some of the other schools, you know, from other disciplines. I think there's a lot of different, I think that's something important to communicate.
Yeah, I did have one last thing I wanted to add. This is kind of coming off the heels of what Arvin was just talking about. I think one of the things that, you know, we do have to, you know, if we were to follow through and, you know, if the agency were to try to develop some pathway or plan, I think one of the topics that should be discussed is where we work geographically within the Forest Service. You know, we have regional offices and with the Washington office that are located in, you know, more densely populated areas. But a lot of, you know, the field offices are located in remote places where there isn't always that great of a diversity. And, talking with some of the few college students that have reached out to me, that was kind of one of the common, concern is the right word, but one of the common questions that they had was like, well, how's it living, you know, in a town of 1,000 people? Are they all racist? Are they, are they going to look at me funny? You know, so I think those are kind of the realities that you know, we're looking at. There's really no easy way to approach it. But I think those are some of the hard conversations that we need to have at some point.
Yeah, I was going to agree with that. That's something that, since I've been with the agency, and I've only been with the Forest Service for 7 years, but it's something that I've heard time and time again. Not just from APIs, but from Black and Hispanic employees as well. It's like, how do you build that just the comfort in the community that's very small? How do we engage with those communities and bridge those connections so that, you know, the comfort levels for both the employee and for the people that are in the city are good. You know, they're cool. They understand how, like, it's an opportunity to learn from each other, I think. And that is something that Hilda brought up is very important. Those kind of tough conversations and how do we approach that? Because that also leads to, you know, in terms of our retention of those employees, we don't want employees leaving if they have bad experiences. And of course, those kind of bad experiences nowadays with the internet and social media and a lot of different things can have a cascading impact that we, you know, that wouldn't look good for an agency. So we need to have better approaches in how we would try to do that, I guess.
I mean, I could say personally, you know, I personally feel my career is limited within the Forest Service. Like, I would not, I you have to think about things a little more, I think, than as an Asian American, about different posts and about where you would go and not only how you would be accepted, but also how your kids would be accepted. You know, I think when you go somewhere and, you know, Hilda, I mean, I think you probably have the best perspective out of all of us, at least in our current positions. And, you know, I mean, you know, looking at, you know, for example, I'm, you know, looking at ranger details or other details, and it's like, well, I just have to think about it a little more about, well, what this community is like. And, you know, not that the communities are racist, but it's more difficult and for an Asian American or a minority to go to those communities and feel accepted or not otherized by that community, but not intentionally, but just that's what happens. And so, yeah, it's a hard conversation. I think that, you know, being a rural, by large, rural-based organization, how can we not just promote this within our organization, but within the communities that we work in? And how can we be pioneers and supportive to those who are willing to take that risk and that step?
Well, thank you, Hilda, Jason, and Arvin.
So, no, thank you, Paul. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. No, it's just cool that there are these podcasts out there like that.
You made the show's focus on Asian American Pacific Islander heritage interesting, engaging, and eye-opening. We look forward to sharing more spotlights on our amazing, diverse employees here on the show, our website, and social media accounts. Thank you for listening. To learn more about this show, share it, or hear our other episodes, please search Forest Focus Podcast. And if you have questions or suggestions on a topic of area of expertise you would like us to feature, please email us at sm.fs.r5ffpodcast@usda.gov. Until next time, enjoy your public lands. And remember to recreate responsibly. Know before you go and learn what you can do to prevent wildfires. Take care. This podcast is sponsored by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Forest Service, and USDA is an equal opportunity provider, employer, and lender.